maybe start engaging yourself with plant medicine and learning about plants. I would suggest picking just one plant that you know that grows where you live. If you don't know one, I know plantain grows where you live. I know dandelion grows where you live. So if you're at a loss, everyone should know what dandelion looks like, I hope. And if you don't know what plantain looks like, I'm sure you can find some outside somewhere. So if you want help identifying those. And you don't need a book. I want to emphasize that. You don't need a book to learn about plants and what they can do and what they can do to heal us. Sit with a plant and talk to the plant about it. And if you're not at a point where you can sit with a plant and talk to it yet, or want to talk to it, yeah, just cultivate a desire where you want to talk to the plant. You know, go in steps to unmasking yourself with all the things that civilization has put on you, and to relearn and to remember who you are as a human being, because I think that's something else that plant wisdom is so wonderful at, is to teach us who we are again, to help us to relearn what it is to have that intimate communion with nature that so many people have been talking about this weekend. And then after you've spent some time with that one plant, maybe pick another one until you have just like a handful, maybe five plants that you can ally with and know them very, very well, because it's so much better to have just a few that you know intimately than a handful, you know, 20, 30 that you don't know very well at all. It's the same as friends. It's so much more like wonderful to have a few close friends and a lot of superficial friends. And I want to close with a quote from a grandmother of the Six Nations First Nation community in Canada that I spent some time with, and she was talking about resistance in her community and just what colonization had done in the lands that had been stolen, and she mentioned in particular the medicines that had been destroyed. And what she said was, at the conclusion of, you know, this long list of destruction, was that she wasn't going to stand for it. She said, I'm going to go out and I'm going to let my creator know that I'm here and that I'm alive, and I'm going to go out and enjoy what he created. And so that tension of being really enraged but really joyful and so hopeful and happy about what was there and what was worth defending. And I guess a warning, too, that entering into like pursuing plant medicine puts you in a place where you have to defend them. It puts you in a position of responsibility that to use these plants as medicine, you have to learn to defend them. And if you don't have a plant that you love or a place that you love, find it. Because if you don't know the plant, you don't want to defend it, and then it'll be gone. We've lost so many medicinal plants already. So, yeah.
My name is Andrea Carrick, and I live in Camden, New Jersey. And I touched on a few different ways that we've been rewilding ourselves in Camden with harvesting wild edible plants such as lemon clover, lamb's quarters, small pokeweed, spiderwort, purslane. But lamb's quarter grows everywhere, and it's three times higher in iron than spinach. It's very good for you. You cook it like a green. And in our greenhouse, where we grow vegetables, we have an appropriate technology, which is a bicycle-powered rainwater catchment system. So in order to water the plants, you hop on a bicycle and ride, and it pumps the water out of the tanks. We pour about 1,000 gallons of water in there. And basically how a rainwater catchment system works is you put it under your gutter, your house, or your shed, or whatever roof surface area you have, and in one heavy storm, a 55-gallon barrel will fill up, and you can stagger barrel after barrel and store as much water as you need. That's a step towards getting off And in the garden, we do as many perennial plants as possible, asparagus, and a lot of the heirloom seeds receive themselves. We also do seed saving. We're not completely self-sufficient in seed saving yet, but it would be a wonderful goal. This past year, Joe McIntosh and I walked around all over Camden to 20 or so mulberry trees and shook them with a tarp underneath and collected enough to make 15 gallons of mulberry wine. We also make dandelion wine. And I have two kayaks, and I'm usually seen in the Delaware River paddling across, or the Cooper River or the Newton Creek. And the waterways, for me, are one of the ways of really breaking through the concrete and connecting with the life-giving forces around us. And I've been camping on an abandoned river island, which you can see as you're crossing the Ben Franklin Bridge. Cool. I think that's it.
Hi, my name is Rachel Semelat. I live here in Philly. And I wanted to talk a little bit about, just kind of what's been going on specifically with women and birth. And, not trusting, just over the last 100 years, the medical system has convoluted birth into just beyond. It's like beyond what you can even imagine is happening. And for all this time up until 100 years ago or so, at least in this country, and what is still happening in a lot of other countries, is women trust each other and trust their community of people, and they birth babies together, and they have community of people. There's like midwives within the community, and I'm a trained doula here in Philly, and being in the hospital system and seeing what happens with women and with birth is just pretty destructive, very destructive. It's destructive to the woman. The women are not being taught that they can trust themselves. They're being pumped full of all kinds of stuff that either to take away the pain. They're basically told that they're not capable of handling what's happening. And it's very much, I've kind of noticed specifically that it is an extreme form of domestication, because you're not trusting yourself to birth, and it just perpetuates then. And then children that are born pumped full of drugs then have all kinds of, it's like there's so many psychological effects. There's effects of the baby, there's effects right afterwards, there's effects of breastfeeding. I'm just kind of touching into this, but it's extremely, extremely important that women understand that how their bodies are made, that they're made for this, that they have what it takes to birth. There's a lot of complications as well, and I think I'm kind of extreme in saying this, but if you're going to have a child, you should be willing to die. And you kind of go into it with that like, you created life, and you are birthing this. And there are factors there, but there's also an extreme trust. And I think that the more we get away from that, that the more our bodies and our minds and our souls and our spirits just will continue to step further away from that, as opposed to coming back to trusting your body and aligning yourself with healing yourself, really. And when you're talking about, like, stepping away from civilization or stepping away from the medical system or any of that, you have to understand that we have been being, like, domesticated, and our bodies are different than they were, and that there are complications that go along with it, but And it's kind of, it's extreme. You're talking about life and death sometimes, you know. But on the other hand, you're taking a stance that that you trust your creator, that you trust yourself, that you can do it, that it's worth kind of turning that around and not letting somebody else take those reins for you. I think that's why it's a huge subject and I'll be playing this question.
Hello.
Hey.
My name is Neil. I'm from coastal Alabama, living in Kansas City, Missouri right now. And I'm going to be talking about using things like roadkill or animals that have been hunted for sport or not used completely, which is the case most of the time today. And I might briefly go through all the steps in making buckskin or rawhide or sinew or something like that, but I think first, I just want to say some people have been kind of talking about today, I think a little bit yesterday, about getting back to kind of what your roots would be, where you come from, where your kind of ancestral land base might be, which is for the people that have spoken with, is here in the U.S., but what about people like me that are from Europe, Northern Europe, places like that? I can still find that making buckskin or any kind of using animals as clothing or any for any practical use, that for any of us in this room, everyone in this room, that's our roots. So it's something that's pretty exciting to me, getting back to something that isn't taking something from someone else. It's not, you know, me trying to play Indian or African or do whatever. I'm like getting back to something that means something to me and where I come from, which I think it's pretty cool. So, but that's, this applies for anyone in this room, no matter where you come from. So, I think it's something that might be important. I mean, everyone won't be interested, but I think it's something that if you are interested, I think you should really try to delve into and learn something about it. Because it's one of the kind of major parts of life, being shelter, clothing, food, water. So, I think it's pretty important to learn along with all these other things that people have been talking about. But so maybe I'll just kind of show some things and talk about the steps. The first step usually being getting a skin or an animal from a butcher or from the side of the road or from a hunter that's not going to use everything. And sometimes you have to skin it. I'm not really going to be able to go into everything. But, so, skinning your first part and then fleshing if you're removing kind of fat and any kind of tissue that's not part of the skin, like any kind of membrane or muscle or anything like that. And then there's just different, people do it different ways. There's different soaking steps, there's different scraping ways. You can do everything completely primitively using every, with a deer, using everything that's in a deer, you can tan its own skin. Whether using its lower leg bones to scrape the skin, it's using its brain to tan the skin, it's using its liver to tan the skin, it's using its, you can get pretty much everything in a deer, which is something that doesn't happen very often when most people just take 10 pounds of backstrap for meat after they take it to the deer processor. But so this is a skin that I accidentally let rot a little bit. So it's, it smells pretty bad when it's wet, but now it's not so bad. But so that's why all those holes are right there in the middle. I don't know if everyone can see this, but this has been through all the soaking and scraping steps. And those holes kind of develop during the scraping just because the fibers have really kind of weakened with that rotting. So you can see it's just hard. It's all the mucus has been, the mucus seems made up of pretty much basically an interwoven system of collagen fibers, and then also kind of the lubricating mucus that is, you know, in our skin right now, it's in every animal's skin. It kind of makes it the way it is. And kind of the key to working skins is figuring out how to get the skin to be dry and soft, which is pretty hard to do. So is the hard part. And then there's another skin over here that, this one right here, pretty much the same, except this skin has been soaked and just the hair and the epidermis removed. So this is just rawhide. Can you guys hear me without the mic?
No.
Not really.
No?
No.
You
want to
take care of it.
So this is...
So this is
the skin just had the hair and the epidermis removed. So this still has the top brain layer and the bulk of the dermis. And under here, this is the flesh side. This is where the membrane and everything against the animal would be. This is the outer side. So you can kind of see that top grain. That's what's in any kind of top grain leather, which is kind of the shiny, water-resistant leather that is used for most leather applications. But I work more with buckskin. So this is kind of another project I'm doing. But this is buckskin, which is what this would be made into, which I don't think I am, because it has some holes in it. This has had the top grain removed. You can see it's a little flatter, more of a matte finish. It doesn't have that shiny top grain on there. So, after all those scraping and soaking steps, the next step would be to soak the skin in some kind of dressing that's really going to, which is basically an emulsified oil that's going to work its way into the skin, into those collagen fibers. And it's going to make it through manipulation and drying, it's going to make it to where the skin will dry, supple, and yeah, like we were talking about earlier. And I'm just going to pick up some of these finished buckskins and toss those out there.
Amazing.
Yeah, these are all from last season's deer that I just finished up this year. You can see some of them have scars on the back. That's usually from barbed wire left over from old farms or something that was been shot. Someone came in. And this is a skin that hasn't been smoked yet. So you can see the difference in color, and you'll be able to feel the difference in texture as well when this gets handed around, And smell, it kind of smells like old grain.
A lot of people don't know old grain.
The smoking really shows the texture, and it makes it to where the skin gets wet, it won't dry hard. Because if that white skin got wet, it would turn back into this. Now I have to work it all over again, which would really suck, because it takes a few hours. And, so yeah. And then I brought some tools also that are pretty important for making. These are some Eastern Woodlands thinner seam moccasins. They just had my old worn out shoes soles sewn onto the bottom. So that's getting more into post apocalyptic primitivism, I guess. Here's a tool that I use sometimes, not so much for scraping, but more for working the skin. If I had it framed out, sometimes I'll use this if a part starts hardening up or getting stiff to kind of work those fibers. And here is a really important tool that almost every brain tanner uses, and it's a softening cable. And even people that brain soften, there's people that specifically soften mainly with the skin stretched out on the frame. There's people that hand soften, and that's a manipulating with your hands most of the time. It's not set up in any kind of thing. But either one, they'll use a softening cable. This is just a 3/16 stainless steel cable from a hardware store. Clamps on the end, and I'll just tie this onto a tree or some kind of post. And the skin, does anyone want to hold this up like a tree?
Like a tree.
So, it'll be up there on the tree, and I'll work it on there, and I'll just pull it back, lean back with all my body weight, because skins are surprisingly strong, and I'll just really quickly move back and forth, and what that's doing is it'll abrade the skin, which kind of opens it up, and it'll also move the collagen fibers around, and it'll kind of warm it up, which really helps it to dry. This is another tool that I use for frame softening, which I use sometimes,
It's just an old shovel handle that broke, and the end has been brought to kind of a flat point there, not sharp, but just kind of flat. And what you'll do is you'll be framed out, and you'll really just lean into it with all your weight and just move the fibers around. And that's the basics of the process. You're not going to really, from what I just told you, if you try to do it, you would fail too.
Makes it sound so easy.
That's true. There's some really good books out there now. I mean, 20 years ago, there was nothing on the subject really. And a lot of people took a lot of time to figure this stuff out. And we have some really good information right now. One book by Matt Richards, in Deerskins and the Buckskins. And this is the best book that you're ever going to go find, well, that you can find right now, on making buckskin and a few other things. It's the best how-to guide I've been able to find. If you knew nothing about tanning skins at all, if you had this book and a skin, and a few things probably just laying around, you'd be able to make something like what you guys are passing around. There's some other good books, but they're mainly for people that already have an idea of the process, and it's just gaining more knowledge about the process. But this is the best book I've been able to find. Deer Skins and the Buck Skins.
Yeah,
volume
2.
Volume 2. Yeah, it's just revised. It hasn't anything.
It's a lot better.
Yeah, a lot better. yeah, second edition. Revised and updated.
Oh, yeah, so expensive. And it's true.
Yeah, and here's some deer hooves, which, I don't know,
that's interesting.
These are just used as ornamentation or musical. Yeah, guitar picks, musical instruments.
Halloween costumes. Halloween costumes.
Halloween costumes. The idea is really just trying to use something that has been wasted. I mean, I personally don't need, even if it was from a dumpster or roadkill, I personally need, I don't personally feel right about that, but I feel something extremely right about using something that's going to be wasted, especially with supporting hunters or something like roadkill. That animal's worth has completely just been made into, you know, it's been made worthless almost. And I think this is really using that animal and give it, I think it's a way of almost giving it a spirit again, kind of resurrecting that animal into something that I'm going to be wearing or using as something that can be teaching people for a really, really long time. So I think, it's something I feel really good about, and it's something that I've really enjoyed learning, and I think it's a really necessary thing for me to learn. Maybe for some other people too. this is sinking. This is deer tendon that's been dried and pounded, and you can just see it's, we use for cordage or string or something. So I think that's pretty much it. I mean, if you want to talk about it after, I'd be more than willing to. I talk about it most of the time anyway.
What are you wearing, Neil?
Oh, yeah.
Could you stand on the chair?
Daniel wants to stand up.
You guys want to stand on the chairs?
So these are just pants made out of buckskin. Leg coverings. I really love using buckskin for leg coverings because it moves with your body. It's extremely soft. It's extremely smooth. It stretches. It's breathable. It's warm. It cuts the wind better than those old people swish swish pants. It's really the best fabric that I've been able to find, and it's just woven by the animal, and all I do is really try to keep it in a state that's usable. So, yeah.
How many times have you had to repair your buckskin?
Never. Yeah. Which is, I used to sew all the time just because, you know, you think you get Carhartts or something like that, they're going to last a while, they don't, they just fall apart. You have to sew all the time, but I haven't sewed them.
We're going to open it up for
some question and answer times. Address any other panel that you'd like to. And in case anybody here doesn't know, this is Keisha Alexis Baker. If you don't know her, she's been a big part of this for a long time. She's done Strategic Radicals with her husband. She's going to help moderate the question and answer time, too.
Thanks. Do you want a mic?
I think what I was thinking about when, as far as moderating this, that I'd like to do is actually for us to be still for a minute and to think about the things that we know how to do. Because I don't know about other people, but when I listen to stuff like this, I'm like, man, I don't even want to see a brain. I don't know how to sew. I don't know how to do nothing. And it's really overwhelming. So if, while we're sort of thinking about questions that we want to ask, if we could just take 30 seconds to think about one thing that you do and that you love to do, that can be seen as resistance, and while we're thinking up the questions. So just 30 seconds. Okay. And the other thing that we like to do at the Jesus Radicals Conference as far as moderating is really trying to recognize underrepresented voices within the space and having those people be some of the first folks to speak. It's sort of been said that, for example, women sometimes take longer to formulate their thoughts, or shyer people take longer time to formulate their thoughts. And by the time the Q&A is over, you know, a whole lot of white males have already asked all of the questions that there are to be asked, and the thing is over. So I want to at least make space in these opening questions for women, for Shire people, for people of color, who I've just been glad to see represented up here but would like to hear more voices of from those of us who are here. If those people have questions, to go ahead and raise your hand, and we'll take stack and then move from there. And taking stack is sort of, you know, when you raise your hand. I'll try and follow everybody. So if there are any women or people of color or shy people or... Charlita. Okay, you're a woman, though, Charlita, so you can ask. Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so I'm experimenting. This is for the, like, dirt people, the gardening and wild animals and stuff. I'm gardening with, like, field dirt under shade trees and trying to figure out what will actually grow there. So raspberries, even some Swiss chard, root vegetables. And I'm kind of concerned about the fact that it's still dirt and no one in the property can tell me where it came from. But I'm still kind of growing it anyway, because I guess it'd be like the collective over a long term that it could probably affect me. But I go to garden shops and ask, how do I test the soil? And they're testing for nutrients, and I'm wanting to test for toxins. What are some toxins? There's worms in it.
That's an interesting.
I know in Camden, and almost everywhere you can go to the cooperative extension, and definitely do lead tests, arsenic, heavy metals, but also mushrooms will break down the soil and take up contaminants, and mushrooms will still be edible. So mushrooms are a good way for bioremediation.
I just had a TED talk on that, which is awesome.
But you really need to test your soil, because you can really poison yourself very badly.
This question is for Rachel. my question is about when you assist a nurse that are in hospital. I just kind of want to know, like, how you feel about that and what you think about when, you know,
It is really frustrating, and as a doula, I'm specifically only there for the mother to support her in whatever decision she makes. The tricky part is that if she doesn't have a really good relationship or trust with her doctor or midwife, and if they're not on the same page, then most likely what's going to happen is that the doctor is going to persuade her of something. And I have no say in that. And it's, I'm even still trying to just not decide, but it's, well, yeah, I'm still trying to decide, but it's really tricky to me that just the process of certification, because I've gone through part of the process and they're very specific about, you know, you don't have a say. Basically, you don't have a say. You cannot make any medical calls or any medical decisions, you know? And so in that, and I'm also really struggling, too, with, like, just the idea of certification. And, like, if I know that, you know, just my background is, like, my grandfather was a leprosy doctor in Paraguay. He delivered my mom. He also delivered me. My mom was Lamaze teacher. I've been, you know, like, I grew up watching her, like, advocate for women. And then at, like, 14 was my first friend that got pregnant. One of my friends got pregnant and asked me to attend her birth. So, like, I feel like it's something very instinctual and very, like, just ingrained in me, and that that's who I am and what I do. And the fact that I have to get certified for somebody to trust me is kind of weird. And the fact that if you, if somebody doesn't have that that natural calling, that they can get certified. And so in the hospitals are just a tricky situation. It's just really, I feel bound a lot of times, and depending on the client, it really depends on the woman, and that's why I'm very adamant about women understanding and trusting themselves and trusting their body, being very specific of what they want and being very, just adamant of it. And even then, I've seen things, like, the doctors just, like, basically do what they want anyways, and it's really, really traumatic, even though they come in saying, this is specifically what I want, and yeah, it's really hard. So the more I feel like I can advocate for women to know their rights, to know what you can and cannot ask for if you're going to go the hospital route, and yeah, and just be really adamant. And that's the hard thing, is because even if the woman is adamant, she's in labor. And so the only, the secondary person would be her partner. And then the third would be me, which a lot of times, or like the doula, which a lot of times the doula mediates between the mother and the doctors and nurses and staff. And it gets tricky and it gets hairy sometimes. You are like, and you have to just basically let it go and let the woman do what they want. Or, you know, like, let the doctor basically do what they want. And
I'm going to direct this question to Joel and Charity, only because they're the ones that kind of got interested in the subject and gave me a pretty healthy respect and worthy knowledge of the subject. But I can go ahead and say that a good handful of this panel would be good people to talk to about it. But could you guys maybe give some good, like, references or resources for foraging, like edible wild foods, greens, mushrooms?
There's quite a few references that would be good for people in all bioregions, and specifically I would suggest the Peterson Field Guides. There's a Peterson Field Guide to Wild Edibles, a Peterson Field Guide to Wild Medicinals, and mushrooms, yeah. And they are localized. I mean, the guides are very detailed, so they'll say where things are located, but they also have, like, Eastern and Western. Yes, Joby. Are you asking a question? Are you adding something?
Well, I have actually just recently found a book I wanted to. Just recently found a book. Right now, I'm blanking on the author's name, but the book is called The Forager's Harvest. The author's from Wisconsin, so it's best to be there, but I love that. approach like Amanda was talking about, he goes really into detail on a handful instead of trying to cover half a page of everything there ever was. I don't remember just now.
Nobody can remember the author's name, or we know the book, but it's called The Forager's Harvest. And so if you know the author's name, shout it out. If not, I'm sure you can find it. It's probably not in a lot of books with that title. But besides the localized Peterson Field Guides, very often you can find a guide that's specific to your state or your area. I know in Missouri you have quite a few Missouri wild edible books, which is more like what Joby was saying, what Amanda was saying. It's good to have a few friends that you really understand, and so that really helps when you have a guide that talks about plants that really are in your backyard. Yeah.
Also, like, if you go to, like, a park or something, or, like, a wildlife refuge, or I don't know what you would call it, but, like, I know Powder Valley in Missouri, I don't know if you guys have ever been there, but they have, like, pamphlets and stuff on just, like, stuff. So, I mean, that would maybe be another venue to get, like, a really localized thing. It's like at a local park or something. Sometimes they have that kind of stuff, too.
Also, Botany in a Day is a really great book to learn how to identify, like, plant families, and it's a just, like, kind of a crash course in botany that can be really helpful as you're seeking to do wild edible plant identification and distinguishing, you know, certain members of the same family and things like that. So I can't remember who it's
Thomas. Thomas J. Elpel.
And one more quick reference is to an herbalist. This isn't as much about food, but there's an herbalist named Susan Weed. Susan Weed.
Should be
her first name is S-U-S-U-N. And any of her books have details of how to process herbs. So it tells how to harvest and how to prepare different parts of different plants for tinctures and all kinds of things. So she's a really good resource for that.
Can you spell her last name?
Weed. W-E-E-V.
M-A-R-I-J-U-A-N-A.
Forager's Harvest was written by Samuel Thayer.
Samuel Thayer wrote The Forager's Harvest. So Samuel Thayer, Thomas J. Elfel, somebody Peterson, what's his first name?
Troy
Peterson, and Susan Weed are the authors that you should look
The local library is a great place.
Again, I'm taking stack. I'm encouraging people who also haven't said anything to just feel free to raise your hand. So one, two, and then three. Go ahead and start. And I'll get you. Go
ahead. One of the elders that I invited to this gathering, who could not make it, is Daniel Baker. Daniel lives in the Saguaro Juniper Land Covenant land that was founded by Jim Corbett. Uh-huh. And I didn't know that you guys were going to talk about goat walking. But I want to say a word to sort of underline your commendation. Daniel, I just wish he would have come. He would have been so heartened, particularly by this panel and the beautiful spirit that you all represent of pursuing traditional crafts. I'm so heartened by it. It's just beautiful and inspiring. And thank you all. Jim Corbett was an incredible figure. He was a mentor of mine. And you remember at the Tucson Learning World School, he had just passed and built an altar and put his Levi jacket on the altar. Huge loss to us because he had so much to teach us. He wrote books, but what he really did is you'd have to go down there and not sit with him, but walk with him if you could keep up with him. And I just, in terms of people, you know, a number of people have asked me, well, who's doing this kind of theological reflection? And the answer is few. But Jim Corbett was one of them, and a pioneer of it. And dude was way over the horizon. If you think that book is good, the book he wrote and that was published posthumously is... I can't even read it. I don't know what the hell he's talking about. He's so... He's just... He was moving from goat walking to communing with the moon. He'd gone on night walks at full moon and new moon. And he was talking about, you know, the gate of heaven and all this stuff. I'm like, oh, wow. And I just want to underline what Joel and Terry have said about his witness as one of the saints and one of the prophets. So the early precursors. He would have had long conversations with him. Unfortunately, when I started doing this work and sort of in conversation with the anarcho-primitivist trajectory 15 years ago, I didn't have the chance to sit down with him before he died. And I just know he would have really, you know, people come to similar insights through different paths and they don't use the same language. Jim Corbett really is one of the patron saints of this emerging movement, and I do encourage all of you to get to know him even better, to make a pilgrimage to the Saguaro Juniper community, where Daniel Baker lives in a little hut. He's living very close to the land. He would love to be in conversation with you all. One of the interesting things that Jim did is, Jim and others, is they developed the idea that we make covenant with each other, we make covenant with God, we also need to make covenants with the land. And it is the only land covenant that I'm aware of in North America in which there was a process, a covenanting process, and a written covenant of what the community that was caretaking this land would do and would not do, and how it would defend the land. It's an extraordinary experiment. It's about 2 hours outside of Tucson. So just want to put that on your radar when you're making some of your feral pilgrimages through the Southwest. Be sure and stop and just walk the land that Jim Corbett's spirit, his wife Pat is still living down there, and the whole beautiful Quaker community in Tucson that is working with him. It's you know, the Sonora Desert is one of the harshest climates in North America, and yet Jim would go for days and days just with a goat. So thank you for bringing him into the room, and thank all of you for your work. Just tremendous.
Question here, question there, question there.
This isn't really directed at anybody, I guess, specifically, but you guys all kind of touched on this a little bit, and I could hear it in there, but I wanted to emphasize to everybody else that, like, each of these, like, individual skills is, like, definitely, like, they need each other, and, like, they, like, thrive off of each other, too, and it's, like, such a beautiful thing how I just, like, hear how if there was, like, I don't know, like, a they work off each other so well, and it's such a beautiful community, communal thing, all these skills. And I don't know if anybody wanted to, like, talk about that, or I don't know, I just wanted to sort of, like, bring that out even more, because I guess it's easy to sort of think, like, okay, well, I want to learn this thing, and I want to learn this thing, and this thing. You know, it's sort of, like, compartmentalized. I don't think any of you guys did that, but I just like to... I don't know, it's like such, it really thrives in a communal thing. I don't think any of you would say that if you try to learn your individual skill or whatever alone, it really, like, would work. So I don't know if anybody wanted to learn that. It's just like,
I totally agree, especially with just, like, the plants and, you know, healing and learning from the plants and understanding your own body, understanding, you know, like, just getting to know yourself and what your needs are, you know, what your actual needs are, you know, like, edibles, plants, medicinal, what's happening when you grow a baby inside, you know, I mean, it does all very well tie together, you know? Yeah.
And you definitely, like, need community to do it, and these things used to be all passed down in the community, and
And that, for me, that's one thing that's really hard about, you know, studying like plant medicine, is I don't necessarily have a lot of people around me to teach me. And so it's a really sad thing, but it's also like a really beautiful thing to see people trying to recover it and, you know, asking other people that do know about it. There's, I mean, I'm sure there are people in your communities that probably still don't want to pursue these skills too, so get together with people and do it.
And it's actually surprising what you might find where you are. I'm in Camden, and I've been apprenticed as a weaver by a woman who's done it her whole life, a traditional weaver. It's been passed down to her from her family, and she's across the street from me. And in Camden, this is a very odd thing. So look for it. You might be surprised by what you find.
I think also some people might be thinking, you know, when we talk about these ideas that we're talking about, kind of macho mountain man, kind of, I'm going to go out and make it on my own sort of thing, but that's not what we're talking about. If anyone didn't understand, like, something, it'd be look more like this group up here, maybe living together and needing each other to survive. You know, Melissa and me providing the clothing, other people providing food, other people providing different sorts of tools and everything. So that's, I think it would look more like that than just me going off and to the Rocky Mountains or something by myself.
I'm going to rearrange that because the sister has a question, so here and then there. Go ahead.
I have one more question. One has to do with what you guys were just talking about. It's kind of like how do you find the time to do things and what other things you do? Like, you were saying it took you a really, really long time to do.
I think there's a couple, at least for me, for me it's been a slow process. One is kind of that's the point. The point is to slow down. And the other thing that doesn't make it a problem is that I love it. So if you pursue things that you love, it's not really, sometimes it becomes like, okay, I should move it up the priority list if I'm ever going to finish this piece. But the point is you're enjoying it. For me, like, it's fun to be interacting with the yarns, to see what I'm creating, to, play with it, trial and error, see what comes out. It's an amazing experience. I mean, granted, the joke with weavers, there are weavers jokes. Is that, like, you learn a lot of words you didn't know you knew and you say, because it can be a frustrating process, but it's like life, and so many things is you're learning, you're working with it, and it's this strange piece because it's you're kind of in control, but at the same time you're learning the whole time from it. So
I think also when it comes to time and making time, that's something that a lot of us have very little of, this free time to do things that we love to do or need to do. But I think that's a really sad thing. I mean, we have to sell our time now to survive. We can't take our time doing those things to survive. We have to sell our time to make money to buy things to survive. Everything's been taken away from us and had a price tag put on it. So I think something that I can really say, I think every one of us needs to do is, it's been a hard thing for me to figure out because I come from just a regular, upper middle class suburban home, so I can't really speak from someone coming from lower class whose parents have had to work so hard and who had to start working when they were themselves very young. I can't really say what this means to that, but where I come from, it's really just trying to eliminate those things that, all those kind of middle things that get in the way of kind of our survival. No matter where you live, I mean, if you live in the middle of Philadelphia, just kind of simplifying things, getting rid of those things that are taking up all your time, and try to figure out how you can directly get the things you need to survive, whether it's food or water or shelter or clothing. Try to cut out all middlegrounds. Maybe try cutting out money for one thing. You know? I mean, I don't know.
That's a good strategy. I would say replacing things in your lives that are mediating your experience. at one at a time. Just take like needles real quick or something, and you find a bone on the railroad tracks because you decided to walk out there, and you abrade it on the cement, and you have a needle. Just that, like, that's a totally like empowering thing to do. All of a sudden, you've just done it, and you go, "Wow, I just made a needle." The store is full of needles, but they'll make anything you want. Trust me. And a lot of things you probably don't. But you, if you can prioritize your, you can sort out what's what do I need and what do I just like to have around. And I'm not ready to throw away a lot of the things that I really enjoy. But try to figure those things out. And like Neil was saying, you know, shelter, food, and water are really important. So even just taking the time to sleep outside one day because you, you know, whatever, it'll totally change the experience that you have in your life.
My other question goes really along with that. It seems like a big theme of rewilding is that it's changing your entire lifestyle. And I was wondering, I wouldn't have thought of this if you weren't on the panel.
I am probably one of the few people, I'll just answer real quick for myself, but everyone would have to answer for them their own self. I hunt deer and use the entire deer as much as I can. So I have a covenant with the deer. It's really serious. I was actually writing up the hunt story this last year, and I didn't get it done for the In the Land of the Living journal. I wish I would have. In any case, my covenant with the deer is that I told a doe that I just shot, and I was holding her in my arms. And I said, I'm just a man. That's all I am. I'm trying to feed my family. I am sorry I had to take you from your family in order that we might continue to live. And I know we can get into vegan stuff and all that, but... And my covenant with the deer is that when I die, I'll just be in the ground, and grass is going to grow off of my body, and their family can eat off of my body for a while, because they've been sustaining ours. So that's what I want to have happen. Charity knows that. Daniel does.
Related to a number of points. I'd like to say, I want to add, I could be wrong when they got my. I found the leather jacket I'm wearing in a junkyard with mold growing. Killed the mold, soaked in a solution, Arm & Hammer, and a little bit of bleach and water will clean it. This is effective. Arm & Hammer. Cheap, it works. Oil it with each oil. Been wearing it for years. Never going to be as warm as it. You might want to check out, people might want to check out, it's an old book, it's been superseded, but it's December. It opened a lot of doors for many people. Francis Moore LaPede, L-A-P-D-E, Diet for Small Planet. Okay, there's a lot more to be said than what she says, but everything she says is pretty much right. Diet for a Small Planet. Poetry of John Steiner. You guys are too young to have heard that name. Poetry of John Steiner. But I want to mention it's also true that the diet and water is, of course, that's a positive. Now, aside, I'm not running around, annoying people, bothering people, I came from what our system somewhere on the high-functioning autistic scale to somewhere in the mid-range or something. my car, 28, 29 miles. I'm fighting back, because it's happening to a lot of people. I can't, obviously, we don't have the time to explain the whole thing, so anybody wants to know, I'm talking. But I did it through diet and exercise. Because of the psychiatric drugs when I was a kid, I still have body rhythm problems that prevent me holding down the regular charge. Now, if people don't care about one individual life, look over my left shoulder, because if you're from a poor marginal background, your child, I'm sure it happens a lot in Camden, you don't have developmental delay, you're schizophrenic. And if by some chance you get out of the clutches of that, of the crocodile, you cannot get civil liberties in New Jersey without a fight. Well, nobody for it. And so you go to the developmental delay system that feeds you sometimes the same drugs and advocates for you, which really means, because there's no advocacy, which really means you're dead. You're dead because they control your life. All the brochures are lies. You're dead. I'm incorrect. And what I'm saying is that if we want to implement much of what Andrea is talking about, more for poor people, for the marginal people, for the people of which maybe there's only a handful in this room, such as myself, I may not look like I came from a marginal, lower, working class background, but I get my parents were dysfunctional. My mother died of this. She had standard medicine. I ran into somebody who studied Chinese medicine. I lived. She died. If you want to make the change, you must address my word is the corrupt tactics that the system uses. They don't just keep the system in place because people are sincere but misguided. They lie. They collude. I got letters sent behind my back with made up stories they didn't think I'd ever see, but I got hold of them. You must address, at least in some places, I don't think South Jersey is unique, but it is a, you couldn't make up a better example. Address that corruption. Do what Gandhi said. Make the injustice visible. Make the injustice visible. That's what I'm doing, and hopefully a few lives will be saved.
Thank you so much. I think I saw Matt.
There's one right there.
The rest. Okay. Matt, as you're waiting, we'll readjust the stack, and then here. And here, and I saw one back there. I don't know what time, Jay, so keep me on.
That could be it.
Okay, fine. Sure, go ahead. Right. So we'll keep questions brief, too. Sorry.
I have one tiny question. One tiny question is, do you know if the goats go along and work with baby goats?
No, I'm sure it would. They're pretty, they have a pretty high, like, the ratio of feed to what they're producing is pretty high. And so I'm sure, I don't really know like numbers on like milk fat content stuff. We've never had any pig and goats, but I always thought about it. I thought, man, it'd be so rad to travel with a couple of them. honestly, like on our bus or something. But I think, yeah, I'm sure it was, you know, you'd have to try it. Range goats are, he talks about range goats, what you might want in a range goat might be very different from what you would want in a show goat. We don't buy show goats. They're real finicky and they're very, like, perfect conformation. We weren't looking for that. We were looking for well-mannered, you know. So any goat that's reasonably well-mannered udders kind of, you know, attached real well. works great.
Then I'm offended as a woman.
Yeah.
It's basically the hormones that a woman produces, that she produces, as she's laboring, and the process of the contractions are actually the same hormones as when you orgasm. And so, especially in like the earlier stages of labor, it can be an orgasmic experience for some women as they're like contracting. And I mean, it just ties in really well with like understanding and knowing your body and being able to ride that. And also the intimacy between the mother and the partner, that also triggers a lot of things. And so the one tricky thing about, specifically about the hospitals that makes it really difficult is that the woman, the two hormones, the one that's like an orgasm and the, like oxytocin, and the other is your fight or flight. And so when you come into us, and they're on opposite, it's like adrenaline, and it's on opposite ends of the spectrum. So when you go into a, like, you might be laboring and everything is great, you go to a hospital, you don't know the nurses or the doctor, and you start getting stressed out, your body's going to shut down. And you're going to pull yourself over to the other end of that spectrum, and so you're no longer like enjoying it and you know, like going into this orgasmic state, you're instead shutting down and flighting because you are not in a comfortable setting anymore, and you're, that is just naturally, animals do it as well, you know, like they find their, the spot that they're going to birth their baby at, you know, and it's a safe spot or whatever. And so, yeah, and here in Philly, some of the, they, there was a movie called Orgasmic Birth, and they showed it a number of times, and it was some of the women I worked with at Powell's, they were in the film and stuff like that. Yeah, it's a great film if you're interested. It's called Orgasmic Birth.
I just wanted to say, well, it's not really a question.
Tell me your time. Okay. Unfortunately, it's closed, but all of these folks are going to be available through the rest of the evening and tomorrow, too. So, you know, please don't feel like this is the only space you get to ask about deer hooves. Thank you.